Okay, great. Well, we do post-session notes and we do recordings that we put up so all the other people can that miss us can tune in at a later date. So this week we've got a great, in my opinion, one of the best programs in terms of website of all the ones we've seen. And we'll get into that in a second. But we always start out with our announcements from Washington. Glo, any news from Washington? Any announcements to make today?
Actually, no. I talked to Joe this morning, and he didn't have any reminders that he wanted me to pass along. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the grantee meeting. As I just said a few minutes ago, we've got about 125 people coming so far, and I expect that there's going to be a few more that register. So it's going to be the largest one we've ever had. I just yesterday finished confirming all the facilitators for the small group sessions, and I know that Joe at headquarters is busy confirming the people that he's going to have coming from the various EPA offices. So if there's anybody on the call that is intending to register but has not yet registered, please do so quickly. We're very quickly running out of space. So send your emails, send your registrations to me just as soon as you can.
Great. We basically have booked up the hotel, and we're doing a few things different this year. We got the two full days and the two travel days, which will make it a little easier for Lynn and April. We're going to be using our grantees as mentors much more this year. We're still relying heavily on our regional coordinators to lean on them for advice and experience and their backgrounds. But we're going to use, because we've developed quite a cadre of mentors and our grantees, we're going to have them facilitating our breakout sessions and bring to the table some of their experience. So we're going to get them a little more involved. In terms of announcements, of course, we talked about the annual grantee meeting. And, of course, Joe announced last week that the RFP for the re-ups or the new grant, the new round, will likely be out sometime in October. I would think maybe late October. It might slip into November. So it really is not too early to start planning for if you're a grantee and you're grant is finishing up or a new grantee. We'll be having some PLC sessions about the technicalities of good job training programs. But that'll be
The job training is what will be included in the assessment, the cleanup, and the revolving loan fund?
They're separate.
The revolving loan fund, the assessment, and the cleanup grants were coming out in October. Am I wrong?
Jeff, you might shed some light on that. It could be that those will also be coming out, but
I think
Joe said that
somewhat close schedules, but they're not linked.
Okay.
They
are independent. Usually the assessment and the cleanups come out first, and then the job training comes out after that.
Right.
I'm not sure how that'll work this year, but in the past, usually the job training has come out in December, January, you know, sometimes in November. So this seems to be a little earlier this year, but they're a little better organized. So we'll take it as it comes. But the key is, whenever it comes out, is to start preparing your program and getting ready for that program. Other announcements, of course, will be that we'll put in the post-session notes. Will include things like the Green Jobs Program that will be coming up. It's a workshop in Washington in April of 2015. And, of course, the National Brownfields Conference will be held next September, September 2nd, in Chicago. And, of course, that's the biggie, 3,000-4,000 people, and that'll be held in Chicago. And we'll be doing presentations there. Anyone who wants to get onto a panel, drop me a line, because we'll probably be setting up a panel If you're going to be going to Chicago and would like to get into a panel, we'd like to use our grantees as mentors and talk about some of the different programs. Last week we had a response from Paula Paris about, we did announce, talk about the NIHS grant RFP that's coming out now. It's a sister program through the NIEHS, and it's more oriented towards worker training, while the EPA program is more oriented towards environmental technology training.
Al Dice in Memphis.
Hey, Al. Good to talk to you. The NIHS program, it's a large program, dominated by a lot of labor organizations, but also some non-organized labor organizations, and it's a five-year program. It's quite different in a lot of ways. Our program is smaller, quick response, annual RFPs, smaller grants, where theirs is very large grants, very infrequent, and large consortias, and takes a lot of planning. In fact, Paula, who had an NIHS associate grant, wrote a note in PLC notes last week and said, it's very difficult to get into. You might become part of a group, a larger consortia. OAI and also out in San Francisco, they were part of both the Brownfields and the NIHS programs. They're different in terms of the health and safety aspects is probably NIHS, although when you look at them, looks like some of the courses are the same, but they're operated quite differently. We look at our program as pretty much small, hands-on, very individually tailored to specific locations, specific needs assessment, specific target groups, and very close interaction with the students, where we tend to look at their program as being a much larger Department of Labor type program. But we'd like you to be aware of that, because when you hear about it, we don't want to get you caught totally off guard. So that's coming out. Today, we're going to continue the discussion that we had last week. Fortune Society, Myra was on the call, and she said that how much she really likes the Fortune website. But when you want to look at websites, and I would encourage when this call is over to go to Zender's website. It's just an excellent site. It's zendergroup.org. And when you go to that site, you're going to see all of the things that this organization does. But when you get into that, you could get into the RACE JT program, which is an acronym for the Rural Alaska Community Environmental Job Training Program. This is an excellent site. And as I was saying before the call started, this is to Lynn and April, they're a rural program, but I think urban areas need to look at what they did and how they do it. What I was really impressed by in their website and their program is everything is laid out. Everything from now to graduation is laid out. They have a schedule where, and April and Lynn will be talking about this, but they have their schedule for their students day by day. What's going to happen on November 3rd, applications due? What's going to happen on December 19th? When are going to be our conference calls? When is the paperwork due on January 9th? When is the first mandatory conference call going to be held on April 3rd? So everything in their application package is laid out. Everything in their program, what types of courses they're going to be taking, when the graduation dates are going to be had, it's all there. Not only is that all there for the students and the student recruitment, but also they have web pages for employers that say, this is what our students are getting. This is the training they're getting. This is the schedule that they're on. So they've got a total package. When you look, it's probably 30 pages of content that goes everything from information flyers, an employer version, a student version, anticipation of the timeline, program announcements, the course listings, what they're all about, how they're supported, what kind of scholarships, and that type of thing. So again, before we get started, I just want to compliment April and Lynn on the terrific use of internet and recommend that everyone go and just start going through that site and go from there. With that, I'd like to introduce Lynn and April from Zender Environmental, and tell us about your program.
Great. Thanks so much. So my name's Lynn Zender, and I'm the executive director and the director of the program, and April McCoy-Reed is the program manager. And just a brief description of the program. As Michael mentioned, we serve rural populations. We serve rural Alaska Native communities, and when we talk about rural in Alaska, what we mean is our folks are from villages. You need to fly a jet airplane into a rural hub of a few thousand people, and then from there it's a prop plane to their village. The villages are not connected to any other village or any road system, and they're from about 60 people to 1,000 people. Not a lot of jobs in their communities, so it's quite a challenge. We provide one cycle of training a year, and that's 4 weeks in the spring, and we do it 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and 2 weeks on again. So we fly folks from their villages to Anchorage and host them here. So that's two round-trip airfares plus lodging for 4 weeks, which ends up that our travel is a huge portion of our budget. Ends up being probably around $50,000, more or less, about half the budget. And let's see, we did try to host something at a regional hub last year because we had some extra money from another leveraged grant, and it ended up being another $25,000. So it just serves us better to have it in Anchorage. We have an overall placement rate. Last year, we placed 100% of our graduates, which we're very, very happy with. And in general, we've stuck over 90% with our placement rate. We have done a lot of things to modify the program as it matures. And we just want to talk about two of them, and then we'll open it up to questions and for any other types of things that people want to ask us about. So one of them I want to talk about is we partnered with the University of Alaska Fairbanks last year to modify our curriculum to some degree to develop what they call an occupational endorsement. It's the university, it's a way, it's just almost like a mini degree program, 10 units. And so when our graduates finish our program now, they finish with 10 college credits plus an occupational endorsement from the university in what we're calling the Rural Waste Management and Spill Response Technician Program. And that was quite a lot of work, a lot of paperwork. We basically had to modify our curriculum into 7 classes that were either classes that were either existing in the university, like they have a fire safety class that includes HAZWOPER, a facility maintenance class that includes CPR, first aid, and 10-hour construction safety. We had to do that, and we developed piloted a couple of new classes, like solid waste management. And so what this does for our students, it provides them college credit. It provides the recognition statewide of a university degree and something where employers can recognize, hey, this person really is qualified for this position. It will provide us, I think, additional leveraging potential as folks realize that our program is legitimate. In fact, I think it has served us already in getting some additional monies this year. And then for the university, why they did it, well, they wanted to meet their community the mission of serving rural communities. They wanted a higher graduation rate for their university. And they wanted to try and get some feeder students into their 4-year program. The university is actually providing us free tuition as well. So, to sum it up, it was quite a bit of paperwork. We had to gather a lot of support throughout the state for the program. Teaching the coursework specific to UAF requirements and standards places some additional burden on us, but it's been all worth it, overall quite a bit, and our students, very happy with that. And then April's going to be talking about another modification.
One of our biggest ongoing transformations has been the first day of class. The first year in 2012, we just kind of jumped right into the training, and we found that we needed to have some kind of transition to help folks get prepared for the rigorous schedule that is the program. We tend to start about, you know, between 8 and 8:30 every day, and we go till at least 5 or 6 even in the evening, sometimes longer if we have more work to do. So working dinners and some working lunches and continuing, you know, on even till 8 o'clock at night some days. We've even had to utilize parts of the weekends that they're here. So that's quite a change from the schedule that they're coming from, you know, very rural. And if they're, you know, they're unemployed and underemployed, so schedule, you know, don't really have to get up too early in the morning and not really a routine set. So we have, at this point, come to take the whole first day as that as kind of a transition for them. And we have all kinds of speakers pertinent to each culture come in. And we talk about each community represented on the roster. We talk about, we connect their values, their community values, to our expectations and our values, the training values. And we find that, you know, they're very similar. We all want the same things. We're all here for the same reason. And so that kind of helps us kind of build each other as a support. It sets the climate for knowledge sharing and support for a successful completion of the program for everyone. We want everyone to graduate. It's set up for success, and so we give, you know, this day serves to set the climate for that group support. And it also helps, you know, prepare them, you know, the first day you're getting up pretty early. They may not be used to that. And, yeah, so that's pretty much the first day. And that has been through, we've been transforming that each year. Last year was very successful. We felt that first day was integral in that success. So this year we'll be doing the same.
Yeah. Does anyone have any questions for anything that we've said or any other aspects of our program? We have lots. We can talk all day about it. I know we only have about 5 minutes.
You know, one of the things that impressed me, and this is something that I've never seen anyone else do, is you have this priority acceptance program, and this is really clever. And we've been doing this for, 10 or 12 years or and no one else I know of has done this, that if you're out there, you're unemployed, and you could go to an employer and convince him that if you get trained, he will hire you. You allow him to write a letter and perhaps get on a phone call and say, I'll hire this person if he gets these credentials. You'll give him priority acceptance. Could you tell us about that? That is a really novel idea.
We didn't realize it was novel, but yeah, and we do that. And again, we're looking at really small communities with very difficult high unemployment rates. So for us to be able to meet a placement rate, we almost have to really prioritize folks who aren't there just for the training, but really can get that job. And it also helps us get folks that are actively searching for a job, I think, as well. I think without that, our placement rate would be much less, you know, maybe half or less. I would say so. And I don't know what percentage of folks have at least some promise of a job when we get in.
Gosh, I want to say it's probably 30 to 40%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do work with underemployed as well, so those working 20 hours and less. And so we are able, you know, also with this training to help increase, you know, their wage to maybe a livable wage as well.
You know, we focus so much on placement, and which is so important. It's the most number one issue in this program is placing people who are unemployed, and this is an interesting approach of letting them do pre-recruitment. And do you find that, do you accept just about everyone who has a has a promise of a job? How does that usually work? Usually, if they can get an employer to vouch for them, and I understand you asked the employer even to get on the line, that's pretty good motivated. That's a pretty motivated participant, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in that case, they would almost certainly be accepted. Except, you know, what we do, criminal background checks, and, you know, it's a couple other things. And we do ask for two personal reference forms as well, which speak to sobriety is one of them, something that we've had, unfortunately, a big problem with just in rural Alaska. So, but in general, that candidate, if they have essentially a guaranteed job with an employer who's willing to vouch for them and who's aware of any issues, which generally they are because they're in the same community, we would bring them into the program.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Also, we do in our selection process as well prioritize, kind of do a point system, but we rank folks who have identified a number of jobs even if they don't have a set guarantee from the employer. For folks who can identify jobs that they're looking for or that might be available in the community, that also gets them a higher score in our selection process.
Well, you know, in your list of sponsors and partners, you've got some real heavy hitters. And again, the thing that's impressive is many of them, a lot of people have partners who are people who, you know, Department of Labor, which you use, and they bring your students transportation money perhaps, or some local agencies. But you've got a lot of employers as active partners, which is really great. In terms of bringing them in, many grantees don't include as the employers as partners the way you have, and I think that also contributes to the 100% placement. I think what the other grantees have to look at is how do you accomplish that 100% placement, and it's pretty clear that you've done some things that are not only innovative but well done. I also noticed when you look at your curriculum, you've done a really good job of needs assessment, that you're really training people for the jobs in Alaska, and your spill response, your landfill operations. While if you were to just look at your list of things you're teaching, you might say that, well, this is kind of disjointed, but really when you think about it, the things you're teaching fit exactly probably with the jobs that you've got there in rural Alaska.
Right, they're very specific to small rural communities, because each community, landfills are a big thing, just because each community has to have a landfill. But yeah, when we first started our program, we did a full-on needs assessment with employers throughout the state, the local governments, and the regional corps, and the engineering firms that will do projects in the summertime. In the communities, and then we continue to talk to employers as well to kind of find out what their needs are. I think we're pretty much sticking with the same curriculum we had last year, though we've kind of honed in on what works best.
You use a lot of, and last time you said you use the radio a lot when we talked to you about a year ago, and do you use Facebook or any of those, or Twitter, any of the other social media? Or phone mostly?
We do a lot of radio. We have we also do a UBIC translation for folks who only speak one language. We use a lot of email and faxes, lots of faxes to cities and villages. And we do have Facebook. We do use a Facebook call out. That's about it.
Yeah, and because the communities that we serve all have tribes associated with them, we take advantage of the EPA tribal listservs as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we have quite a presence with that.
One of the things we're going to be talking about at the all-grantee meeting will be communications. And I hope it's all right if we use some of your materials. I think you've really adapted. One of the hardest grantee programs that we have are rural brownfields because they're spread out. And the urban grantees have much easier time both in recruitment and placement because there's tons of people, there's tons of employers and lots of job opportunities. You're probably tackling one of the most difficult. When you talk about the two hardest brownfields are one is tribes and two are rural, and you've got both of them, and 100% placement, which is really exemplary because we find that those are the two hardest types of environmental job development and training programs to keep going. Are you able to, do you have enough applicants? Do you find that you have to really beat the bushes to get your applicants in, or do you find that comes fairly easy over the years?
Yeah, that's a good question. The first couple years we had kind of consistent numbers, about 35, 40 applicants, and partly, which is somewhat of a small number across the state. On the other hand, it's a very kind of stringent program, and the application process is fairly strict with the references and the oral interviews and all that kind of thing, and that's actually a good number. Last year we actually had less, and I think they're for a number of reasons, partly because of the the sequester or something hit right at the wrong time, and we as I said, we use tribal governments quite a bit as the outlet in the communities, recruitment outreach in the communities. And of course the municipalities also rely to some degree on federal government money. Communities in general are heavily government reliant for their jobs. So when that happened right at our right in our recruitment period, it kind of hit a blow. But we were actually able to call out as the program started. We have a lot of contacts through a number of communities and looked at particularly some of the tribal response programs that had some active jobs there, and they were able to send us some great applicants to fill up our class in the last half.
Great.
So that was good too. It really helped to have that kind of networking ability.
And then, of course, as your graduates get great jobs and the word spreads and they become your best emissaries in terms of advocating your program, getting new recruits in. Anyone else have? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no. Go ahead. Yep.
Any other questions? Anyone have any questions about the work they're doing up in Alaska, how they're doing it? If it's okay, if someone either in the session notes or listening to this has any questions, okay if we get in touch with you, put your email in our notes. Is that all right with you?
Absolutely.
It's great. Well, we hope to see you soon and hear about your programs and really share with you, with the group, with the other grantees, some of the things. As I said, you're doing several things that really not a lot of the other grantees are doing really actively, and I think you do them out of necessity because of being as rural as you are, but you've got this so well planned out that someone could go to that website, and I would encourage everyone to just go to that zendergroup.org and not only see what they're doing in this program, but they've got EJ program, what they're doing in EJ and some of the other programs, but just kind of flip through the six or seven different areas in terms of this program. And it's called the RACE JT program, and see how they're laying this out in terms of planning and allowing not only the students and the communities to know what they're doing, but also the employers to see what they're doing, what they're taking. And it's all out there on the website. So it's, I think that that's a great approach for everyone, whether you're in Alaska or in Cincinnati or Orlando. So, well, thank you very much. Oh, go ahead.
And it's actually called Race Jet. We call it Race Jet. We kind of think of a plane taking off. Someday we'll get a logo.
Okay. Very good. Well, thanks, everybody. And April and Lynn, gee, thank you very much again. And we'll see you soon. And we'll lean on you for more information at the annual grantee conference.
Excellent. Thank you for having us.
Talk to you all.
Thank you,
okay.
Everyone.
Thanks everybody.
All righty.
Have a good day.
Good day, everyone.